jazz.
Busted.
We'll see what happens.
Well, the voice you hear there is Mike, the tech whisperer. He's trying to coax his laptop into behaving the way it needs to so we can record Jazz Bastard Podcast 170. I'm still Pat.
He's still Pat, and his electronics are working just fine.
Thank you, Korea.
Thank you, Korea.
Keep doing that good work you do. Anyway, listeners, we're celebrating an interview of us that went up on All About Jazz talking about our podcast. We think came out pretty well. If you're interested in the origins of the podcast, the philosophy behind it, you might take a look at that. But part of the talk there, one of the questions was, well, how often do you guys talk about pop for the main podcast? We always have a Pop Matter segment now. And it occurred to me that not that often, and we hadn't done for one for a while, so maybe we should do one now because we've got a couple brand new pop-oriented releases in the pipeline for review. In fact, one of them is called Pop. So I thought maybe we'd do two of these new releases that have lots of jazz elements but are, you know, vocally oriented pop-ish albums rather than pure jazz, and talk about two earlier albums that also kind of straddle that line. So for today's podcast, we're going to talk about Ricky Lee Jones's Pirates from 1981, Erykah Badu's Baduism from 1997, and then for the new ones, Vivian Sesom's Life 2. There's Life 1, we're doing Life 2, and that's out now. And then the Yellow House Orchestra's album Pop, also from 2019, and that is going to drop later in the year, I think in August. I've got the date somewhere here. So anyway, two new albums, two older ones. We're doing Pop this time, but I think every one of these, would you agree, has got some jazz and improvisation in it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Some more than others, but yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
I know as a kid, I don't know whether you heard a lot of Ricky Lee Jones growing up. I felt like, you know, Chuckie's in Love was big on the radio when I was a junior high school age kid.
No, I wasn't aware of her until college. And I'm sure that you were the one who brought her to my attention. So, yeah, that was something that you introduced me to way back when.
Yeah, well, I think it makes sense. Let's just start with her because it's the earliest work. Yeah, Ricky Lee Jones kind of bursts onto the scene in 79 with her self-titled debut, and there's this big hit on it, Chuck E's In Love. And boy, nothing less likely on the face of it to become a radio hit. It's kind of a jazzy, beatnik-esque story about this, you know, this person you've never heard of, but she seems to be familiar with, is Chuck E, who is in love with someone. And it turns out by the end of the song, he's in love with the singer. The whole album was kind of very left of center. It's not at all punk. It's certainly not new wave. It's kind of got its roots in jazz and singer-songwriter material. And she was a very idiosyncratic personality. She kind of slurred her singing, moved around the notes a lot in an almost jazz-like manner, and gave a very bohemian appearance on the cover, and had a very interesting life backstory that, you know, Rolling Stone investigated in great depth, and was girlfriends with Tom Waits for a while, just kind of a very unique performer. And she released that album on Warner Brothers. It was a big hit, and it's still kind of a staple at audiophile shows. So the sound of it is prized by people who are into that sort of thing. And then she followed it up with this more ambitious album, Pirates, in 1981, and then she had an EP, which I uploaded. I don't know if you got a chance to hear that, which
absolutely
included a couple just straight jazz covers and Lush Life. And there's another one that's like right out of the jazz songbook. What's the other obvious jazz tune she does on that? Do you remember?
She does Lush Life, and I just had it up here. She does Lush Life, and where is it? I'll tell you in one second. My Funny Valentine.
Thank you. Right. Just real. This is Girl at Her Volcano.
Also Something Cool.
Yeah. And then she releases an album called The Magazine, which got a mixed reception, and then, you know, left Warner Brothers and didn't record for several years more, and since then has had kind of an intermittent career. She's released and recorded albums, not on a real regular basis, and she's always been a cult artist since the early 80s. She's never gotten as big an audience again, but, you know, I think she's done a lot of valuable work since then. So Pirates, I picked out kind of because, in, for many people, it's the peak of what she did. It was not the commercial peak, but very ambitious record. I don't know how you listened to Pirates much before we did this podcast.
So what's funny is when you made the suggestions for this podcast, one of the things I had already had sort of on my listening in my hopper that I was already listening to, and then another I had just uploaded to listen to, I had and hadn't listened to for a while, and I just uploaded that. And for a long, I don't know, since this road trip of mine started, when I set out, one of the first things I put on it was Ricky Lee Jones's Naked Songs.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
A later live concert in San Francisco where she performs a lot of her hits or better known songs on piano and guitar. So it's kind of weird. It's like three of the four things already in one way or another were kind of in my head, which is kind of interesting. And Ricky Lee Jones is great driving music, by the way. Like, all Ricky Lee Jones is really good for driving vast distances in a car. So, yeah, I have Pirates. I think I have Flying Cowboys. I may or may not have her first album. I forget. So, yeah, and then Girl at Her Volcano, that was a nice get. I like that a lot, actually. I think that's extremely jazzy. So anyway, we're talking about Pirates, and yeah, I had heard it. I've been aware of it and have had it for I don't know how many years. Yeah, it was nice to sort of for this project to be, you know, listening to it again, especially having spending a fair amount of time listening to Naked Songs, her live versions of many of these songs. Geez, 20, 25 years on at that point. So, yeah, I did have some familiarity with her. But, yeah, I think you were the one who initially introduced me to her music ages ago back in college.
Yeah, and as a kid, I gravitated towards, you know, Chuckies and Love, and in part because it was just like the Sultans of Swing by Dire Straits, a song that was popular on the radio but had some roots in jazz, you know, had some roots in that sensibility, and you didn't get a lot of that in your ears if you're listening to a little clock radio in the late 70s, early 80s in your bedroom, the local small town radio station. You know, there's only a few things that they were going to play that had any bearing on jazz. Chuck Maggioni's Feels So Good Every Morning at 6:30 when I got up. That was in the rotation for what seemed like a year and a half. And there was a certain time of, I think it was 6:30. They played that song every morning.
Huh.
It was kind of a ritual. But yeah, you know, obviously it's in that period of time that there were only so many artists who were making any kind of nods at all towards jazz. And, you know, I like that about her. She's an eccentric singer. She sometimes sounds like a little girl. Sometimes she has a very distinctive sob in her voice. And kind of presses down on the emoting scale, and she will do some scatting. You know, some of the songs, Danny's All-Star Joint from the first album talks about a jukebox that goes doit doit. She's bringing in some scatting and bebop language into her kind of beatnik persona, and I think largely it works. I mean, I don't feel like it's too put on or anything.
No, I mean, she was called the Duchess of Coolsville for a reason. still is called the Duchess of Coolsville for a reason, because she is the definition of cool. I mean, she is extremely cool. She also has, as a vocal tick, she can drop down and do this sort of growl around her lower register. And as she's gotten older, so I can just tell you from, you know, listening to Naked Songs, but by that point she's in, I think, her 50s, she still can hit the high girlish sounding notes. I mean, she can still sound like a little girl on lots and lots of her songs. But that sort of lower register growl, it's not quite a growl. she just kind of, you know, kind of just mouths these weird low notes. That's even better as she ages. So she has this ability to kind of, like on the song Coolsville, she'll do that. So yeah, she as a vocal technician, she's really interesting. No one sounds like her. I can't think of anyone who
sounds no one. Yeah, that's anything true.
Like her, or anyone who would imitate her, because to imitate her, you'd have to imitate, really, it's like imitating three different singers. There isn't just one Ricky Lee Jones standard sound, you know? I mean, she's got that sort of girlish, high-pitched, almost vibrato-free thing that she does, but she's not really off-key. It's just, you know, it can be kind of keening and piercing. But then, like you said, she can scat, and she has this sort of lower register. It's not really Sarah Vaughan-ish, right? It's not that low, but she does this kind of low thing. She's one of the few vocalists I could imagine that would give Joni Mitchell a run for her money in terms of, as a folk/jazz singer, they are like their own niche, the two of them, kind of. There's them. If we were making the Mount Rushmore of female folk jazz singers, right? It's Joni Mitchell, Ricky Lee Jones, and then I don't know who else goes up there. I mean,
And they're very different artists, but yeah.
They're very different, but they both have this, you know, monster technique. They have a lot of tools in their toolkit. They can do a lot of different stuff.
Yeah,
they both have berets, and they've earned the right.
There we go. Right, that's true. They both do. For me, she is cool in the sense of a bebop sensibility and in jokes and slang and somebody who has seen the streets and knows, you know. But in terms of a performer, I think Ricky can get a lot hotter, whereas Joni tends to be a chillier persona throughout. And yeah, Joni's also in her younger years, you know, very pure.
Yes.
And Ricky, you know, she slides around a lot. You know, I listen to Girl at Her Volcano and things, and there are moments where you might say, has she just lost the thread? I think largely, no, I don't feel like she's just indulging herself to the point where she is just kind of sliding around notes and missing things or screwing up. But it's a very different, you know, she's not into the kind of laser-like precision that Joni to some degree displays, or, you know, Ella Fitzgerald or Sarah Vaughan at their most precise can do. But, you know, she is really talented. I think she's really good. And Pirates is distinctive because, whereas mostly the debut is got songs in the 3 to 5 minute range, and it's a sequence of songs. Pirates is 8 performances, and some of them really kind of morph throughout. The first song, We Belong Together, has got this surging, hooky refrain, but it changes volume, it changes intensity, it changes melodic material through the course of it. You know, it's not a neat little package. And several of the songs, I mean, you know, The Western Slopes is almost impressionistic. It's a little hard to put your finger on what the song's about or what its melodic kernel is. So what do you think about the more experimental bent of this album? Because in a way, I think it's...
For me, the signature cuts are We Belong Together, and I think Living It Up is one of the greatest songs ever written. And I can't imagine anyone... It's a song that I can't imagine anyone doing it and go, oh, that's the definitive treatment. Her treatment is the only treatment of that song I can imagine. Living It Up, like you said, it changes. It's a sort of poetic, impressionistic kind of opening. And then we get to that chorus, Living It Up. Yeah, we're living it up, which is, to me, sounds deeply ironic. And it's played over and over again on the piano. It feels to me like two different songs, sometimes three different songs.
Right, yes.
I just love that song. And for people who like Ricky Lee Jones, I got to tell you, if you haven't heard Naked Songs, Hy-Vee to a UCD store and get you this album, because her live version of that, it's just her alone on stage. Her live version of that on piano is just epic. It's just epic. You know, I mean, It's fantastic. So for me, those are like the two, those are the two signature moments here. But I like the whole thing. The other thing that kind of blows me away, I mean, so this is often talked about as like her breakup album, right? You know, it's breaking up with Tom Waits. It is a sad motherfucking album.
It's just,
you know, I have friends who joke about how some of the things I listen to are what they call sad bastard music. This is sad bastard music. This is you alone drinking a beer by yourself, ruminating on how your life didn't go the way it should have gone. This is your soundtrack. It's a great album. But it is very fucking sad. It is a dour piece of work. It's great. I mean, I love it, but it's also like when I listen to it, I'm like, what have I done with my life? I'm so lonely.
There we go.
I mean, it's just profoundly melancholy in a way that the only other person I could think of who does stuff like this, interestingly enough, and he's not as good at it as she is Tom Waits. Early Tom Waits often sounds like this, although Tom Waits is much more of a butterfly, and he has many more moods on his first couple of albums. He has these sort of sad, ruminative songs, but he also has, you know, just comedy, and, you know, he does everything. And this whole album is a buzzkill. It's a great buzzkill, you know, but it's like you're in a good mood and you put it on, you're like, oh, yeah. My life has been for shit, you know?
I guess the moments of, you know, We Belong Together, and of course it's ironic, but
it's
the music, the building, the drums, the anthemic nature of that chorus are living it up. You know, it's, I don't know, there is something still uplifting. And, you know, on these early albums, she has an absolutely crack set of studio musicians. You know,
oh,
Steve Gadd and the Brecker Brothers.
Half of them are jazz guys, and the other half are guys who want to be jazz guys. The Brecker Brothers, but, you know, Walter Fagan is here. My God. Victor Feldman on drums. David Sanborn. Tom Scott. Holy shit. Isn't Chuck Rainey, doesn't he have jazz cred as well, the bass player? Or no, he does, but he's more known for like Steely Dan stuff. Anyway, yeah,
I feel like the one thing that her later career is still very, very good, but the excitement that the musicians generate and the sheer budget of this, you know, it's so weird to think of they bring in this early 20 something beatnik boho young woman, and she records these albums of all original material with the best studio musicians in the world, and they're extraordinarily eccentric. And because, you know, her first record, she has this huge breakout hit, you know, they let her do that for 3.5 records. And it's this amazing testament, you know, and of course, then she goes to Geffen, and then it's more indie stuff. And I mean, I like a lot of her later stuff quite a bit, but it is this amazing run. And it's just so, she's like nothing else particularly going on in music at that time. The song structures here are maybe a little reminiscent of Laura Nyro. She tends to be the person you think of as, you know, in the 60s, early 70s, writing these kind of sweet, like moody structures that aren't just verse, chorus.
Right.
I mean, Waits to some degree, you know, mostly his stuff, it gets weirder and weirder. But
right.
Structurally, in terms of just a song being a song, it doesn't change that much.
No, he's
whereas, you know, some of these are really, you know, they're a little more ambitious.
He's avant-garde. Yeah, he's much more out of Tin Pan Alley. You know, he has very recognizable song structures for the most part. He doesn't get out in terms of, he's not experimental as much as, you know, and he's got a zillion different voices too and a zillion different personas. But yeah, his songs are, he did a lot of 3.5 minute songs. You know, that's, his albums are built that way.
And yeah, they get stranger and more abrasive,
you know,
in some of the later stuff, which I like a lot, but they remain songs. Yeah. And of course she just multi-tracks her voice in this amazing surging choirs. In a way, it's weird because, you know, she had a very unusual bohemian upbringing. And, you know, part of the whole vibe of the record is the romance of the downtrodden in the streets.
Yeah.
But she and Tom Waits and Steely Dan, you know, who all share the subject matter.
Yeah.
But somehow the bohemianism translates into the most beautifully polished studio work, you know.
Right.
I mean, she's got a lot more rough edges in terms of just the music in the first couple of records. I mean, you know, when the drum gets hit, you jump in your chair. It's there willing to do some dynamic swings. And her voice is just more immediate and more emotionally gripping than Donald Fagen's. Of course, I love Steely Dan, we all know. But it is odd that these people from that era, you know, from that milieu, create these records that are, in a way, they're not yacht rock, but they're all the elements of yacht rock. It's just the attitude is different enough. You don't really classify them that way.
Yeah.
It's not about, you know, the beautiful lifestyle of the rich and famous. It's about the downtrodden lifestyle of the people that like jazz and drink out of paper bags and have messed up love lives and don't have any money. But man, it sounds so good. So it's a weird contradiction.
And, you know, the other miracle about her career is that they let her get away with the shit for so long. Like, you do Chuckies in Love, and, you know, most studio heads are going to be like, right, give me another Chuckies in Love. And she never does.
Yeah, I mean, some people complain that the singles on the magazine were retreads, but I got to say, you know, that album has got a couple things that aren't great. I've grown to like it more as I've aged, but I think the pop songs on that record are just some of my all-time favorites. I mean, there's one about fry him some catfish up in bed or something. It's like, okay, this is ridiculous. It's called The Real End. But as a song, it's irresistible to me. It's just like, every time I hear it, I'm a very happy little boy. And it's like, it's not Chuckie's in Love. It's sort of the same subject matter. She loves horns, and I love horns. And apparently, she did the arranging on the horns. So, I mean, again, this is somebody who writes these lyrics. They're very poetic. You might find them self-indulgent, but, you know, she's creating them. She writes all her own material. She has help with some of the arranging, but she's arranging for horns. I assume she's arranging her own vocal stuff. I mean, she's just got a fucking volcano load of talent. It's hard to explain. She was not formally trained or anything, but
no, she has a weird up.
She makes these amazing records. It's like, where'd she come up with this shit? You know, it really is. It's like hard to kind of process what she was able to create in these short years with Warner Brothers. Just like, man, you know, where did all this energy come from? And again, this persistent nostalgia. When I hear those horns, I always feel like it's 1979's or 81's dream,
right,
of 1972 or 68. It's kind of already nostalgic sounding. Even as a kid, yeah, they sounded a little look backwards looking, but I just love that sound.
And that's not when she made those albums. She was 26, 27. That's not the normal 26, 27 year old emotional trajectory to sort of be saturated, to kind of be bathed in that sense of loss and nostalgia, right? I mean, you're 27,
right,
26, yeah. you're Beyonce, you know,
in her case, you're supposed to be wearing shoulder pads and like putting 5 pounds of hairspray on your hair. But yeah, she was not in that fucking scene. You know? There's no one less 80s on earth than Ricky Lee Jones, even though that's really when her career hit big. So I don't know. I've enjoyed everything she's done. I think when she came back, it was with a Walter Becker produced album. I think you've mentioned it already on Geffen, Flying Cowboys.
Yeah.
And I mean, when I first heard that, boy, it sounded much more distinctively adult contemporary to my ears. It's, you know, the horns are largely gone. It's glossier sounding. The production does sound more like the 80s, and the intensity to some degree is not there, but it's a good set of songs. And then she just goes on and she does albums of covers. She does Pop Pop, which has got a lot of jazz on it. As you say, she does Naked songs. She does It's Like This, which includes a cover of a Steely Dan song. And she does albums of original stuff. So it's Ghosty Head. I've always, half that album I like, even though I know I shouldn't, I really like it, which is a weird kind of trip hop, you know, experiment she does with electronics and stuff. And like, turns out she's really good at talk singing. You know, I mean, that's something she's always done a little bit of. It's like, damn, I still like half these songs. They're ridiculous, but they're also kind of awesome. A neat figure. But if you're interested in jazz, but also like pop or vocals, and if you missed her peak, God, all these years ago, back in the late 70s, early 80s, you might look her up. You might try her. See if you like her. Some people bounce off her.
Yeah, I've heard people, I mean, I've heard people complain, you know, they just can't get into the voice.
Right.
The little girl voice, but I'm like, can you just hold on and listen to the words?
It's not like,
you
it's know? Kate Bush.
What's the character's name? And it's not the one who's got a crazy eye. He's in, I guess it's Chuckie. He's in love. You know, he's looking at her when he's got a crazy eye.
Well, I think it's something off Pirates, actually. I know who you're talking about. I can't think of whether it's,
the lyrics are just brilliant. I mean, you just they paint these amazing little stories that if you don't like the sound of a voice, just hang on a minute. Just listen to the actual words of the songs.
Right.
They're amazing.
Yeah, clever little bohemian narratives and just truckloads of empathy in them. And yeah, I mean, I think we talked about Kurt Elling having this reaction on some people, or giving some people this reaction. Tom Waits, does it all seem like some kind of act? Is it all some kind of pose? You know, do you hate people who pretend to be beatniks? Or, you know, I don't particularly I think she did. I get the weird sense that her trajectory is somebody who had genuine experience on the streets and did live a rough and tumble existence, but also just had the kind of talent and obviously just discipline and determination that when you put her in a studio with some of the best musicians on earth, she produces something like this, you know? So
yeah.
She was both of the streets, but by her nature, her talent was not going to stay there and ended up, you know, building a pretty decent life for herself because she was just enormously talented.
Yeah.
And so there's that sense. It's like, well, is that a contradiction? I don't know that it is. I think she genuinely had that experience. It's just that, you know, given her talent stash and whatever, she grew out of it. I mean, she, you know, not that she's given up on the people that don't find a lot of success in life and live at midnight and live a bohemian existence, but you know, she's somebody who didn't have to keep doing that because she was just had a fuck ton of talent. So it's a, yeah. You know, I don't know that much about her personally, but you get the feeling it's like she ends up in a pretty nice house in a pretty nice neighborhood. And she's kind of looking around like that Talking Head song saying, well, how did I get here? And it's like, well, you Boreas aside, you could do something that, you know, only a tiny percentage of human beings could ever do, which is, you know, funnel this. Not only did you have the talent, but you were able to create things with it. Because some people are enormously talented, but so self-destructive. Cool stuff. And Pirates, it takes a while. It took me a while for me to get into it because some of the pleasures are delayed and built up. But it's worth investing time in. All right, so our next album is from 1997, and it was a landmark in the neo-soul movement, Erykah Badu, Baduism. You know, I got her follow-up albums, and going back to them, I think I like them better, but this album just had so many amazingly strong songs on it that they always seem to be in her shadow. And she's, you know, she's around, she still produces music, but she's never been a prolific, you know, she produces more than D'Angelo. Oh, that's not hard. But she's not somebody who's like an album a year kind of a lady. And for a lot of people, I think this is still the landmark. And it's an amazing work. And you said you were listening to it before we even talked about doing it on the podcast,
It was just so weird. I got, as I mentioned many times on the podcast, I have a random system of adding things to the portable listening device and, you know, swapping old things out and swapping new things in. And I had just swapped in Baduism like the day before you said, so let's do Baduism.
Yeah, like, cool.
Okay, that sounds good to me. Let's do it. So yeah, I just slapped it in. What was interesting to me is this is another performer who you've introduced me to. I just kind of missed the neo soul movement, and you've been the one to kind of draw my attention to D'Angelo and Erykah Badu and a handful of other folks. I'm gonna be the naysaying voice here a little bit, because I know that everyone just loves the shit out of this album, and I like it, but I don't love it. She has jazz bona fides. She's recorded with a bunch of folks. Probably the name that we've talked about on here the most, who she's recorded with, is Robert Glasper. She was on Black Radio. But what she gets name-checked for a lot among jazz heads is the idea that she kind of sounds a little bit like Billie Holiday. I guess I'm not buying. She has one thing that Billie doesn't have and lacks another thing that Billie does. She has a much better set of pipes than Billie Holiday. She has more polish, more rounded notes. I know why people say that, because she has this kind of weary air sometimes. The single On and On is a good example of it.
Just the same. Oh, no, no, no. My life again.
just this kind of weary, I'm just tired kind of affect that can sound a little bit like Billy in some of her numbers. So she has she actually has way more notes, and she has way more polish than Billie Holiday.
Like just a hint of vinegar, you know, just a hint. Bit.
And I think that's where people sometimes mention Nina Simone, someone who I don't like much at all.
Right.
And I like Erykah Badu way more than I like Nina Simone. But what Billie has is, you know, Billie just, she milks every emotion. You feel that she feels that she's selling an emotional take, that the lyrics mean something. It's just part of neo soul or, you know, new soul, whatever, that it doesn't always, it often feels more polished to me emotionally.
Yeah, much cooler, right? I mean, this is a cool, she is a very cool artist.
She's extremely cool. She's way cooler than I am. She's a million times more cool than I'll ever be. And I like this, but I am not in love with it. I of the songs here, for me, the one that really kind of registers is the damn single. It's an earworm on, and I just can't kind of get it out of my head. Some of the other songs I like, but they don't mean that much to me. I enjoy them, but they don't stick in my mind as much. So I like this, but I am not a giant fanboy the way that some people are Erykah Badu fanboys. And I know that you like her a lot more than me. So make the case to the kids at home why they should all rush out and get down and study Baduism.
Yeah, well, and you know, I think mainly it's just Mike is jealous. She has much better candles than he does. There's just no question. It's like, there's some
fucking
better awesome
candles. She has better hair.
Oh, yeah.
Everything. She's an amazing person. But yeah.
No,
but
right.
If you're going to make a case for why this is important, because you would make this case and I wouldn't, why is it important? What's so
well,
important?
And again, I don't want to, you know, to me, I didn't listen to D'Angelo until the last couple of years. I kind of missed this crest, and it wasn't really aimed at me. It was aimed at younger urban African Americans and hipsters, you know, not
pointing out D'Angelo kind of semi discovered her because she was his opening act when he was important.
And the movement, I think, as somebody who is perhaps skeptical at times of the symbology or the kind of, I don't know if I want to say hippie, but mystical aspects of, you know, I mean, I love it when she says, I've got some food for you, not the food that you eat, but food for thought. You know, it's really cool because I know she has a sense of humor and she's extremely bright. It's also kind of silly, you know, and I'm enjoying it, but maybe, and there may be some people that are saying like, just feed my brain, Erica. And I'm not, you know, I'm not taking her that seriously. I mean, to me, this is just an amazingly produced record. She's got a very hip singing style that is flexible, that does seem intuitive.
Yeah.
I'm not going to compare. She's not one. To me, it's always hard to say is someone like a jazz singer when they're singing all originals, because how can you tell? Is there another way? You know, it's just you don't hear them bending known material to their will. You hear them presenting their own stuff. But she's got that kind of flexibility of voice. She's got just the slightest hint of vinegar.
It was a stormy night. You know, the kind where the lightning strikes. And I was hanging out with some of my artsy friends. Ooh, you, you. The night was long. The night went on. We were cooling down through the break of dawn. Incense was burning, so I'm feeling right. I picked my friends like I pick my fruit. Think Annie told me that when I was only a youth. I don't walk around trying to be what I'm not. I don't waste my time trying to get what you got. I work at pleasing me, cause I can't please you.
Instead of tragedy, there's often a sense of humor and intelligence and irony sometimes in what she sings. It's very cool. I just think there's several irresistible songs. I think Rimshot is just a lot of fun. I remember Joyce saying, what does it mean to slip someone a Mickey? And it was just a weird saying she had not run across. And of course, it's weird because even now it's kind of a joke and it's used metaphorically, but now it's like you gave me a knockout drug is like you would not put that in a song because it's just in the Me Too era. That's like accusing this guy of rape, right? You know?
Yeah. When she sings about a rim shot, do you think she's talking about a snare drum?
I think she is. Yes. There could be no other meaning to what she sings. And that is what it means. It is a celebration of the, look, it there are rim shots there.
I will say this, in terms of music, Ron Carter has never sounded fatter than he does on this album.
Oh my God, I guess I should have looked. That's one thing I did not do, is seek all the personnel here, because I don't think of this as...
He's the bass player, they have got him pumped to the max.
Oh, it's Subterranean, yeah.
Well, sorry. He's the bass player on one track.
Okay. But
whatever. Yeah, it's fine. If you must know, he's the bass player on Drama.
Okay.
But he never sounded fatter than he does here. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you again. I apologize.
It is okay. Yeah, to some degree, especially when I was younger with Ricky Lee, you know, some of my favorite songs of Ricky Lee's were the kind of the up-tempo, jazzy ones, and the really hard-on-sleeve emoting ones could be a little bit much for me. Erica's got a couple slow, more didactic pieces about it's hard to be the lover of this guy that's selling drugs when he shouldn't be, but it's helping support them, that maybe go on a little bit too long. A couple of these songs going a bit long. I think by the end of the record, when she's reprising songs, I'm less into that than I might be. But to me, they're just enough delightful tunes here. I mean, not just On and On, but Rimshot's fun. The Apple Tree song, you know, I was hanging out with some of my artsy friends. Ooey, ooey, ooh. I mean, that's a deathless line. Right. You know, the lightning strikes and the bass is just thump, thump. I mean, it's you know, the irresistible tunes. And there are just enough of them on here that, you know, it's fairly unusual for me to run across a pop record that has half a dozen really catchy, really memorable tunes. And I'd say, you know, Four Leaf Clover might be a little bit more kind of a little more conventional, but it's at least hooky. Certainly, I think is a really great song. Great bass, great lyrics, Apple Tree, On and On, Rimshot. I mean, you know, you're getting to the point where half this record are tunes I really like. And then the other half, you know, they're fine. The neo-soul stuff, I think partially is it's so much about bath oil and candles and groove. And it's like, I've got so much music that does that even better. There's this album called Kind of Blue that turns out, you know, or whatever. You know, I've got dozens and dozens of records that if I want like a chill mood, but fucking genius is playing, I can get that anywhere I look. I mean, I keep going on about Art Farmer. It's like he made a few of those, you know. So when it kind of gets more meandering, I do lose focus. But I think overall, it's a fantastic record. And she tries to get a little bit more political. It gets a little bit more freeform. It gets a little bit more Marvin Gaye-esque on Mama's Gun. And yeah. I can't remember the next one, America, or something.
Yeah, America Part 4, World War 4, or whatever. Yeah.
You know, and those, there's a lot of valuable music there. And coming back to them and having some distance on them and not expecting as much to get the kind of sugar rushes I got from Bad Jewism, I appreciate them. But I'm still more likely to put Bad Jewism in the rotation. There's not a lot of, there's probably less quote-unquote jazzy horns or whatever on this one, but there is a sense of the groove being important. There's a sense that performances have room to breathe. It's more about, it's not just getting the pop message across and leaving. And, you know, she's got this flexible voice, full of personality, very idiosyncratic, that, you know, I think is highly appealing. I mean, her persona I like. She's not made a lot of compelling records that I've run across that I've returned to, but I like Bad Jewism. So, anyway, that's my defense, such as it is.
Cool. There are people who swear by her, and especially this album, and you can find... like I said, I like this, but you can find defenders of this who are, you know, will throw down about how groundbreaking, landmark, utterly essential this is. Okay, I like it. That's as much as I can say.
Yeah, when I listen to Kendrick Lamar or somebody, and maybe that's a masculine bias. I mean, among other things, one thing you're getting from Erica is kind of this nurturing, you know, it's feminist-centric. It's about what it's like to be a woman in these relationships that have these problematic aspects. It's about loyalty. It's, you know, and I get that. I mean, to me, the neo soul movement, the whole neo, put neo on something, and it's going to be, it's like, you know, the neo, you know, the Wynton Marsalis generation of it's always got a certain sense of received stuff. I mean, there're not a lot of gestures on this record that sound brand new to me.
Right.
But I think it's a really fucking good record, so I don't care. And it did introduce a mood, a worldview, a kind of adult music that was about a separate set of topics and about a sonic world, but yet did not seem toothless or M.O.R. to me. Didn't seem like it's just another branch of adult radio, but was meant for grown-ups with bath oil and candles. It wasn't meant for horny teenagers.
It wasn't
about the agony of being 15 and pimply. It's just, you know, it's about adult concern. So
that's
I can
a good
see
point,
you know,
here that this is music for grown-ups.
Yeah, you know, it's like, so I get that. You know, if that's what you're looking for, I mean, she fulfills that need in a way that, you know, a lot of artists don't. Anyway, I like it a lot. And man, that bass. Oh, that bass. You know, it's a fun record to kind of just crank up on a decent system and bang in.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right.
The best is yet to come, and baby, won't that be fine? You think you've seen the sun, you ain't seen it shine.
Well, we've all had our breaks. And we're ready for part two of the podcast. We're going to do some contemporary stuff. Do you have a preference, Vivian or Yellow House Orchestra?
Either one's fine. You go wherever you want to go.
Okay, well, maybe it makes sense to talk about Vivian Sessoms, S-E-S-S-O-M-S, first. She's a vocalist, and she released two albums. I think it was originally a double album. She decided it was just too much music for one release. I have not heard Life One. We're talking about Life 2.
Oh, really? Because it was one of the albums one of our services gave us to review. So I've listened to Life 1.
I must have missed that somehow. I'd like to hear it. I mean, I don't know about you, but I like Life 2 quite a bit.
I do too.
And it sounds like she must have worked as a backup singer in various capacities. She's worked with such artists as Michael Jackson, Donna Summer, and Chaka Khan. So clearly has been playing in the big leagues for a long time, but not necessarily known that well as a leader.
Right.
And they gave a list of like 15 or more musicians on this production, but there were so many they did not even give instruments with them. So this is quite a production, and it's a sprawling, you know, hour-long record that really covers a lot of different ground. It begins with pretty much a jazz instrumental.
Yeah.
With some vocal additions, which I think is quite successful. I do not know if Vivian also plays instruments. She obviously is a vocalist here. And then it just moves through some originals, some very interestingly recast covers, and, you know, just kind of wins its way. She's a very powerful singer. What do you think of Vivian Sessoms' Life 2?
I like it. A couple of things here are just dead earworms. I mean, you hear them and they're locked in. So for me, different songs work in this regard. The one that is the strongest here for me in that regard is The Best Is Yet to Come.
Oh, yeah.
I cannot get that song out of my head. It has a really lovely horn arrangement, and it's a cool song, first of all, but the horn arrangement is killer. It's just got this kind of but it's very restrained, you know, eighth notes or whatever. My God. And every time that starts up, I drop what I'm doing. I just love that song. It's just sassy and cool and sexy and smart. So the horns totally got me on that one. I also think that her cover of One Thing Leads to Another is simply awesome.
It's pretty fucking
awesome. I absolutely. So for the kids who don't know, One Thing Leads to Another, who the hell is that? Is that Yes? Who is that?
No, it's The Fix.
The Fix. Oh, that's right. I can't remember. I suddenly had Yes in my head. And I love that song. Like, The Fix's version of that song is the shit. It is a great song. It is a great pop song.
Very 80s, very new wavy, kind of tight white boy funk.
Yep. And her version just is awesome. It is incredibly cool.
It's your case with black or white. Oh, a little cross is the shot with your teeth. You want for cover so discreet. Why don't they?
a great, great song.
There was some Afrobeat in that, maybe?
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. When it first starts, you don't know that you're listening to that song. You know, it has a kind of interesting muted beginning. So that is one of the great, great covers on this album. It is simply brilliant. And then I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that oftentimes we complain about political songs or jazz that does politics, particularly when it goes into sort of, particularly when it picks up stuff from hip hop or rap, that it's not as effective. It feels preachy. It feels instantly dated. I don't know what. I Can't Breathe. It's a great song. I Can't Breathe Strange Fruit for the 21st century. Holy shit, that is an awesome song. So for those who don't know, if you've been like living under a rock for the last 20 years, I Can't Breathe is what, I think his first name was Eric Garner. He was someone who was restrained by the cops. I believe, if I have the story right, it was in New York City. He was selling cigarettes, and I might have been in public, might have been on a subway, I don't know, but was held down in a chokehold by cops and famously was able to get the words out, I can't breathe, and they strangled him. He died of asphyxiation. And so those words, I can't breathe, have become a kind of slogan, or slogan's not right, quite the right word, a kind of, you know, powerful claim about oppression and racial discrimination. And
right, it's a phrase with a very well-known meaning. You know, it's a reference that, you know, yeah.
So when I saw a song called I Can't Breathe, I was like, okay, I was ready to hate it, you know, because it's like, you know, I love the message. I'm down with the message, but I'm not very in tune with political songs oftentimes. And I just felt it was a really effective piece of work. Her voice is deployed to stunningly good effect in that song.
Yeah, she's got some pipes. She's got some power. Okay. Yeah.
That for me, emotionally, that is the kind of highlight. That's the peak of the album. It is really powerful.
And no desire to be strong. Said, I can't.
Having said that, there are also some light numbers here that I kind of dig. I didn't know if the little 1 minute 17 second Sa-Rah was a shout out to the collective Sa-Rah, who, you know, children of God, who have appeared on. They're sort of a, they're a trio of music producer makers derive their name from Sun-Rah. And, you know, have appeared on many albums. And I didn't know if she was shouting out to them or not. It's a delightful little short piece. I like If They Only Knew. I like this album a lot. But as I said, certain things really were peaks for me. The Best Is Yet to Come, I Can't Breathe, One Thing Leads to Another. Those three songs alone make this a really strong album. And so, yeah, I'm this impresses the hell out of me. Mark Whitfield, the guitarist, who I think we've talked about him on an earlier podcast, he appears here, and there's a handful of other musicians, some of whom I believe have appeared on other releases that we've talked about. I like this album quite a bit, and I prefer Life 2 to Life 1. I think this is stronger than Life 1.
Yeah, I read that elsewhere, you know, because Downbeat put her firmly in the neo-soul movement, and I guess I can see some ties to the kind of music Erykah Badu was making back in the 90s, but I think the sheer fact that her voice is so powerful and has certainly elements of like Aretha Franklin or whatever in it, you know, that kind of gospel affect, I just don't associate. It's hotter, right? So
yeah,
she is willing to get a lot hotter in her singing, not always. I mean, there are moments of kind of the drifting, you know, let's get the bath oil stuff, but a lot of it, you know, one thing leads to another, which is, you know, an amazing, there's a version, I cannot think of the artist now, a complete remake of the Talking Heads album, Remain in Light, done as, you know, as African style, which of course it was drawing, the album was drawing from heavily at the time. And this is another one that has some of those elements, and it just, there are so many ways it could have gone wrong, but it was very intelligently put together and very catchy, and it's very distinct. It's not trying to copy what the Fix did, but it preserves enough elements of the song that it's right on that border, because sometimes covers are too faithful and it's just like a reproduction. And then sometimes, you know, if you just take so much of the song away, it's like, well, fine, but really this is just you kind of emoting, and it doesn't have much to do with the original. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't bring you the pleasures or you know, remind you of the pleasures the original gave. So, you know, I really like that. Anytime we get an album that is more pop from someone, I've never heard of this artist. No idea, you know. So I'm going into it expecting it. I will not like it. Period. And not that I'm biased against it. Just, you know, 90% of quote unquote new pop music. I, you know, it's not that I'm going to hate it or dislike the artist personally or something, but it's probably not going to appeal to me. I mean, it's just this many years of listening to pop music, you get to the point where you're like, you know, you kind of, a lot of it, you can see, I've heard that done before. They're doing a fine job. Young people will love this. I don't need it, kind of stuff. And so I was, you know, wow, this is a good record. I enjoy playing it. I would just play it for pleasure. I think she's hugely talented, and I think it's really intelligently put together and arranged. And it's pretty ambitious. I mean, some of these performances go on 7 or 8 minutes.
Yeah.
Some of them are a little sweet-like. They go through more, so they're not as extreme as what Ricky Lee Jones is doing. Not a judgment call, just, you know, they aren't quite as, the highs and lows aren't quite as separated on a given track. But she's certainly willing to develop an idea at length, let you have the instruments have some say in it, explore it, without, I think, getting boring or repetitive. But it's, you know, this is not a record of 3 and 4 minute performances that are just neatly packaged and you just easily digested and forgotten. So yeah, I strongly recommend, you've heard Life One, and I've read that Life One maybe isn't as strong, but I'd say this album works very well as a album, and she's a fine singer. I'm always a little nervous when somebody's that powerful and it's in a lot of backup singing. It's like, are you going to control it? I mean, I know you can do a lot of things. Are you going to do too many of them at once? I think largely she's got a pretty good aesthetic hold on what she's trying to do. You know, there might be moments where you think, yeah, you know, maybe you got a little too rococo there or whatever, or you oversang it. But I think for the most part, no, you know, that she earns what she's doing. And of course, she can do it. I mean, hell, she's got a house of a voice, right? I mean, it's, you know.
I should also point out on one of the songs that there's some rapping or rhyming over her singing. Yeah. That's her cousin. That's a family member, Major Green. And then her partner, her husband, he produces and appears on most of the tracks as well. So this is kind of a labor of love by a couple in some ways. So he had a lot to do with the making of the album. So his name's Chris Parks, and it would be remiss if we didn't mention that he was important. And she's credited him for having a lot to do with the putting together of this particular album.
And that can be a warning sign. Sometimes, you know, the domestic dynamics do not result in great art. But here, they seem to have a great vibe, and they are productive together, and it's not self-indulgent or sloppy or whatever. Yeah, the rapping is, it's pretty intense, and it might lead you to think that the album is going to be more focused on that sort of thing than it turns out to be, but I like it. I think it works fine.
Yeah.
I felt like when I get to the Fix, it's like, okay, you know, you've been, I can't breathe in political protests. And it's like, but for you white people from the 80s, I've got a Fix cover. But then I, you know, read that she was actually, you know, cause it's like, I mean, this is red meat for a Generation Xer, you know, it's like, because that is one of my favorite songs from that period of time. I just think it's great. And she does a fantastic version of it. But it is a landmark that, you know, a white guy from the 80s recognizes. But then, you know, I read somewhere that she felt like, well, the politics of it resonate today. And I never thought of that as a particularly political song, but I never really thought about what it meant at all. You know, it's just...
Right.
And, you know, it does sound like, you know, you can imagine the whole thing being sung to a politician, and it's about hypocrisy and whatever. It's like, okay, I get it. You know, so I, you know, you resonated to it, and it certainly, I mean, it comes off great. I keep thinking, boy, they should play this on the radio many, many places, because it's awesome. And she did say her favorite track was the Yes, Best Is Yet to Come, which it was weird. I've not heard that song much, but the one place I've heard it was I watched one episode of Carol Burnett. And so Leslie Ann Warren, who's a strikingly beautiful young woman at this time, comes out, and she's in a slinky outfit, and there's male dancers, and she sings the most awkwardly, quotation mark, sexy version of the song I've ever seen. It's just like she's really trying the hardest she possibly can be to be sexy, and it just comes off as like she's been kidnapped and they're making her do it. I don't know. This is really weird. It's like
that song is by Cy Coleman.
Cy Coleman. It's a standard, but it's a lesser standard. Known one. Yeah,
lesser known, recorded by Tony Bennett, by Michael Bublé on "Call Me Irresponsible."
Yeah,
Blossom Deary, Bob Dylan, Ella Fitzgerald, Stacey Kent, Chaka Khan.
A good song, verging maybe on camp. Certainly when Leslie Ann Warren does it, not verging on camp anymore. Firmly in the camp.
In camp, yeah.
Oh yeah, I just said really weirdly awkward. Just I don't know. It's like if you're trying really hard to be sexy, you aren't sexy. I mean, that just it's a contradiction in terms. It's like what you look like some woman who's dancing in like some kind of Amsterdam window. What is going on here? But yeah, not one you hear much and. Yeah, brilliant arrangement of it. So, yeah, strongly recommend. I think it's a good record. To judge, who are you to judge? It's time for airplane. I can't believe that we just budged. At least Carlos Santana said today on the airwaves. Next time, let's not make something that So what do you think of Yellow House Orchestra's Pop?
So I don't have a lot to say about this. It's a fusion of Latin salsa with some, rock and jazz and pop influences. And I liked it. It did not make a big impact on me. The cover that I recognize here is, of course, Little Wing, which is the Jimi Hendrix tune, which has been covered, by all kinds of jazz folks in the past, probably most famously by, I believe, Gil Evans. I liked it. I don't know anything about these guys. And we've talked about Latin jazz is just a kind of weak spot for both of us. And if I don't know the players or don't have a lot of connection to them, I often find this kind of music pleasant and engaging, and I like it, but I have a hard time. I just have a steep learning curve with some of this stuff. I have a hard time distinguishing what makes some Latin fusion jazz better than other Latin fusion jazz,
particularly
when it's an ensemble that isn't heavily featuring a particular player or set of players that are readily identifiable, to my ears. So I suspect these guys have been around for a while. This is not their first album. They've made several albums.
Well, at least two, I think.
I think they've been around longer than that, though, haven't they?
It's apparently co-led by two musicians.
Yeah.
Arranger and trombonist Doug Beavers and then Michael Cerda. And I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that, Michael. They say he's bassist, vocalist, guitarist, composer, and band leader. And so I assume he's the only one I find named playing guitar. And there's kind of Santana, Steely Dan style guitar solos throughout this, which I think are very accomplished. And I assume that must be him. And then I'm assuming he's the one that sings the vocals that remind me a little bit, not of Donald Fagen, but of Walter Becker. I've never heard anyone, and I never expected to hear anyone that reminded me a little bit of Becker. Because one reason I was drawn to this release was, to me, several of the songs, it's certainly a lot of these songs will begin in a quote-unquote pop or crossover mode, and then about halfway through, they'll turn into a Latin salsa breakdown. And it's a weird, it works, and I enjoy it. I enjoy both halves. And apparently, he began thinking this was going to be a Latin salsa album, and then decided he was, as the songwriting progressed, it was going to include these other elements. But a couple of the songs remind me very much of Steely Dan. David felt a bit nostalgic. I told him that he had to try. Riding on a ditch across town. So he took a little ride on the 79th Street cross town. And then some, I guess I never draw on the connection between like Steely Dan and Santana.
Hmm.
Steely Dan was never a Latin band, but There's instrumental interludes. There are horns. There's always a top-notch percolating rhythm section. And suddenly I kind of thought, okay, they are different from, but not completely siloed off from, Santana or Latin jazz. I mean, this band made me make that connection. So I found a couple that I felt like the last song, the 79th Street, whatever, had some earworms in it. That was the most, to me, openly in lyric style and melody and whatever Steely Dan like. Pop at the beginning reference, at least Santana's still on the airways. I mean, that's, I guess, for me, what I kind of liked about it. And I just feel like he's good at writing those kind of 70s style melodies. He's very good at doing the almost mathematical or angular style of guitar solos you get like in Steely Dan projects. And then sometimes sliding over, because think about it, it's not that different from Santana's guitar style. So there's that going on. There's a lot of good horn playing and some pretty good horn solos. And a lot, especially in the middle of the album, of just, you know, Latin jazz salsa stuff, which I agree with you, sounded very accomplished. I enjoy it, but I don't have the ears to kind of pick out qualifying elements from the genre very well. I'm still
Maybe to put it a different way is, depending on the players and the soloists, sometimes there is enough of a stamp on the material that on a very quick set of listens, it will connect for me. And so that happened. I talked about this on Pop Matters ages ago when I talked about this record, this anthology that I'd picked up, Fania Records from New York City, which had a lot of New York Latin pop stuff on it. And on some of the cuts, I was like, okay, I can see now why that vocalist or that trumpeter is, you know, head and shoulders above other people. And you can pick that out on one or two listens. And otherwise, you know, a lot of it was just really pleasant music, really, really good party music or whatever, what have you. And that's kind of how I feel about this. I just feel like with some music, I don't have to listen to it as much before certain things burrow their way into my brain. And with this, it just takes me longer. And I like this. I think it's good. I think it's really accomplished. It's really enjoyable. But I don't have that strong sense of, oh, I know the melody on that one. Oh, I'm looking forward to the trombone solo here. And all the players are fantastic. These are really good players. It's just that it hasn't kind of penetrated beyond a certain level in my head. And that just may be a defect with me with this kind of music. It's just, it takes me longer to kind of connect to certain kinds of jazz or certain kinds of music. And you've mentioned this before, that this is kind of a weak spot or a black spot or whatever you want to call it, a place where my ears aren't as accomplished or as immediately receptive as they are with other kinds of music, which isn't to say that, you know, I don't like it. I suspect with many more listens, I will be like, oh yeah, wait for that break there on the timbales. That's going to be awesome. You know, but right now it doesn't have that for me. And, you know, that happens with, it's not just Latin jazz. It happens with, we talk about this, especially with young performers who are recording their own originals. It happens a fair amount of the time where you're kind of like, really good players. I don't have, you know, hooks here that grab me. And it will take me longer to kind of dig into this. I've said that about some of Ambrose Akinmusire's music, you know. I mean,
a very different issue, but yeah, right. Same deal. It's like, hard to connect to it.
But player, but I can't, you know, I don't have an in yet. Orally, it hasn't connected for me. So yeah, I mean, I do like this stuff though. I think it's really good, and I could totally see blasting this at a party. Because it is infectious, it's pleasurable, it's enjoyable, it's up-tempo. I like it. I can't be more specific because I don't have that connection to it yet. And I feel bad about that. I feel like I should, because these guys are really good. I thought, reading on a website somewhere, that I saw one of the players, one of the saxophone players, because this is a unit that has West and East Coast membership, you know. So
there's something like 19 musicians involved or something. It's a big, yeah. Right, yeah.
I believe, I thought I saw Corey Wright mentioned in some promo material somewhere. He was a guy who was associated with the industrial jazz group for a time. So
okay.
It's not surprising that, you know, a unit that has really good players on both coasts is going to have people who appear in other units that I may have heard in other contexts.
Makes sense. Yeah, I'd recommend this as a kind of a bit of a donut album where I like the middle section, but the middle section is, to me, the middle songs there are more just traditional Latin salsa workouts. And there's one song called Celebrate that is just a bit jejune for me, just a little bit soft-centered. But the beginning tunes, Pop, Got It Going On, To Some Degree Out of Sight, From All Around, 79th Cross Street Crosstown, the ending songs, I think are strong. To me, they were hookier, and they slotted into that part of my brain that loves 70s jazz, rock jazz, like Steely Dan, you know, and right. Santana to some degree, you know, where there is a memorable melodies and very much of that school. You know, it's like something you might have heard in the 70s. Good production, great musicianship, just with the oddity that some of these songs will go on and all of a sudden in minute four they become another Latin breakdown.
Right.
And I enjoy that. I mean, it's always fun. It just structurally, the album does seem a little bit torn. It's like, well, I mean, you do this really well and it works, but too many of the songs for my taste go from one thing to the other. And after a while, it's like, well, do you guys just want to play Latin? Because, I mean, that's cool. Or do you really want to, quote unquote, make pop songs? Because, you know, there's nothing wrong with pop songs with Latin elements. But at some point, if it ends with 3 or 4 minutes of Latin workout, it's just a different kind of beast.
Yeah.
But that said, every time the transition happened, I kind of enjoyed it just on a visceral level. And yeah, this, I guess I've always been more of a fanatic of Steely Dan and that kind of era of music. And boy, this guy, he plays solos that sound like they came from a Steely Dan. I think he must have listened to them a lot. I'm just guessing, but I mean, really just very much. It's kind of a distinctive style. I don't know all the guitarists who've walked through it, but just very polished, a little bit more ambitious than your typical rock guitar solo, little slightly mathy, not crazy, not off-puttingly so.
Mathy is a good, that's not a bad claim here. That's a word I probably should have been looking for when I was talking about this. I do have the sense that these guys live would just fucking blow the roof off the dump. Live unit, they would just be a handful and in a really, really good way.
And I don't know that either. There are some, especially the 79th Street song, which for some reason reminds me of the last track on a Weird Al Yankovic album about falling in love with this woman on a Crosstown bus. Anyway, it's a song about a bus. They don't quite have a distinctive point of view in terms of, is this also about, you know, kind of bohemian lowlife, or is it about politics, or is it about celebrating nice things? You know, I don't know there's a distinctive lyrical vision here, and that, especially because, you know, some of the songs are just in Spanish, and I'm unfortunately monolingual, and I don't know what they're about. So there is not that world building that you get on a Steely Dan album, or, you know, some of the yacht rockers, where they're creating a milieu in the music. You know, you're a cast of characters. So there's that lacking. But boy, it just, for me, it scratched that itch of music from that era, and again, just accomplished musicianship and a sense of propulsion. You know, when these songs get going, I have trouble turning them off.
No, oh, yeah.
You know, there's a kind of momentum to them. I like to keep listening to them. So on that grounds, you know, I don't know that it's as focused. I mean, the Sesames kind of moves around a lot, but
yeah,
in a way it's got a clearer point of view, and it's more clearly about Vivian's takes on various songs. I mean, it's more centered around a singer. This has got a lot of guest singers, and who I assume is a lead guy. Again, you know, he reminds me of Walter Becker, which means he's not a great vocalist. You know, he's not, you know, I think he's a little stronger than Walter, but you know, he's not somebody who's going to bowl you over vocally in terms of charisma or technique. And that, I think, is part of also what gives me that Dan vibe, is, you know, they were never about overpoweringly great singers. I mean, Fagan's, you know, a little more accomplished, but that's not what the point of that was. So anyway, I liked it better than you did. I think it's a good record, but it's a little odd. And if you don't, you know, like Latin jazz, don't listen to it, because it's 60% Latin and salsa, and then just this other stuff, which I think he does pretty well. He's got the idiom down. I don't know if he's quite got much to say in it. Well, do you have any other
matters? I wish we could talk about it in 2 weeks after I drive, across the country, because this will be in heavy rotation in the car because it's good driving music.
Oh, it is. No, it's excellent driving music. You can perk playing along there.
Maybe in 2 weeks I'll have more to say about it after I've listened to it 25 times going across the country.
One you want, babe. I'm not the one you need. You say you're looking for someone, never weak but always strong, to protect you and defend you.
Pop matters. I'm always rotating things in and out. And so different things pop in and pop out. Oddly, because there's a new documentary out about the Rolling Thunder Review, the bootleg series volume 5, which covers the Rolling Thunder Review live in 75, 76. Bob Dylan had just entered the rotation recently. And I was like, oh, wow, how serendipitous, because there's a new movie out about this. It's really good, Dylan, and it's electric, of course. And it's, by his own admission, he thought of the Rolling Thunder Review as kind of like a traveling circus. And these are some of the best versions of these songs he ever recorded. So, I mean, there are a lot of really, well-known songs here. It Ain't Me, Babe, A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, Mr. Tambourine Man, Simple Twist of Fate, Mama, You've Been on My Mind, Blowing in the Wind. But they are performed here electronically. He's got an electric band, and he is more engaged and more vigorous than probably he had ever been before. And they are really powerful renditions of these songs. The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll here is really a kind of a showstopper. So if you haven't heard the bootleg series, I highly recommend. There's actually two discs in volume 5. I'm just talking about disc 1 of the Rolling Thunder Review. It's definitely something to listen to. And then, speaking of sad bastard music, I slapped onto the old portable music listening device, Neil Young's Live at Massey Hall 1971. And it's just Neil and an acoustic guitar and a piano. And it is one, it's like the male response to Ricky Lee Jones. It's one depressing fucking song after another. And his patter between songs is quite good because he's kind of got this stoner, mellow vibe going. And so he's live in Massey Hall up in Canada, and it's just really good. And some of these songs, what's interesting is in 1971, they've never been recorded before. He hasn't put them on wax, right? So I believe, let me see if I have this right, I think Man Needs a Maid, he's talking about his introduction to that song. This is the first recording of it, right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he says, he's got this whole trippy introduction where he says, sometimes you think there's a movie of your life? Well, this is a song from the Broadway musical of my life.
God.
And it's just, and it hasn't been recorded yet. Uh-huh. And all of the songs are, all the songs are recognizable. Old Man, Helpless, Love and Mind, Cowgirl in the Sand, Don't Let It Bring You Down. But it's all acoustic guitar and piano. And God, is it, it's just really, really sad. You just want to take Neil aside and give him a big hug afterwards. Some of the songs he gives you an explanation for, which I did not know. So like Old Man, he says, he just recently bought a farm up in Canada. I guess he still has this farm. And he said there was an old man who lives on the farm, and he just kind of lives there. And so the song Old Man is about the vagrant who lives on the land that Neil Young bought. And I had no idea. So lyrics, you remember the lyrics, Old Man, Look at My Life, I'm a Lot Like You.
Except about, richer, much, much richer.
Much, much richer. But it's like about this homeless dude squatting on the land that he's just bought with his newfound wealth. So that's kind of interesting. But like I said, it's just him and a piano and a guitar. And it's really sad. It's just fucking, the whole thing is like melancholy. There's not a happy peppy number here as far as I can tell. Even the song Dance, 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 which you think would be kind of up, is not.
I just can't imagine Neil Young doing a Dance, Dance, Dance song somehow.
Yeah, so highly recommend it. I think it's really good. It's a really good window onto his career in 1971, but fuck. It's just a lot of sad bastard music on my portable listening device. I might have to do some weeding before I drive, or I'll go into a river at some point, you know, just from all the depressing music.
Some happy music on there. You can
do it. Do you know that album? Have you listened to that album?
No, I've heard about it. You know, I'm not a huge Neil Young collector, but yeah, it sounds interesting to me. I just, you know, I queue him up occasionally, but yeah, I guess I don't. I've got other ways to be sad, so.
You don't need music.
Put on Tonight Tonight and just kind of want to die. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, I've you know, at one point, I got into picking up a lot of Neil Young and Bob Dylan, because I often get into things long after everyone else sensible has gotten into them, and so I acquired, good Lord, most of Dylan's recorded output, you know, even up through the Christian era, right through the mid 80s, and then I stopped. And same thing with Neil Young, you know, but Neil Young remains more relevant, I think, longer in some ways, and so I acquired one release of his after another. And so this was right in that period where I was picking this stuff up. And it's awfully good. Have you ever, by the way, I've only heard bits of it. Have you ever heard the I think it's on XFM, or maybe it's on Sirius. Supposedly, I don't know if he still has it, Bob Dylan had a curated radio show on XFM or Sirius.
No, I never know. I think they've merged now. I think it's one thing, but whatever, I know.
I remember reading about it and people who had kind of found it talking about how it was just fucking genius, because he has a huge, as you might imagine, whatever else you think about Bob Dylan, he's got an enormous range of interests. And so you'll hear like a really obscure blind Lemon Jefferson cut, followed by some surf pop from 1973. You know, it was just a dip into the mind of Dylan, and all of the cuts were like weird and obscure things that he liked. But, you know, what he likes ranges from stuff dating back to 1920 and up through girl group Motown, you know. I mean, so I'd heard that curated program was brilliant, and I'd heard a snippet of it somewhere. And, you know, he has these weird, as you might imagine, these weird rambling monologues as a way of talking about the songs, which sometimes refer to the performers and other times are like beat poetry that he's smoking at the moment. Who knows? It would be interesting to listen to that station and hear what he has to say about some of these people. Anyway, sorry, that was a rant off in a whole other direction. What have you been listening to?
Even though your folks hate me, there's no one like you, Eleanor.
You know, not a lot. I was looking through, and I think the only pop-related thing that I've gotten recently that's newish was another birthday gift, The Turtles, Save the Turtles, Their Greatest Hits.
Ah.
It's an odd little pop group from the 60s. They're best known for Happy Together. They give the story behind each song. They strike somebody. The impression given from their discussion is they're this group that didn't quite get how the pop game worked. They had a huge hit. They kind of sort of tried to replicate it. They weren't quite sure what was wanted of them. They were not, you know, naturally charismatic looking. You know, one of the guys just did not look like a rock star. You're kind of plump and curly hair and just, you know. And coming back to it, maybe it'll grow on me. I enjoyed some of the tracks. Apparently one they made they thought was a parody called Eleanor actually did pretty well. based on the chords of Happy Together like backwards or something. And I realized listening to it, it's like, okay, this is kind of silly, but then did they realize that most lyrics from most songs in the 60s were also pretty much this silly? I mean, you know, what makes something a parody of music like that? It's kind of hard to put your finger on. Oh. If it's not really extreme, it's just a little odder than a lot of what you'd hear. So, you know, I'll see. I'm going to keep trying to listen to them, but I don't know that at this stage in the game I'm ever going to become a big enthusiast. And maybe it was more, if at the time you knew there was more to them than people realized, they were kind of a cold item for you, but maybe I just missed that boat. I don't know. Again, it's not that I dislike it, but I was hoping it would be more revelatory than it turned out to be. And that concludes episode 170 of the Jazz Bastard podcast. If you'd like to email us, you sure can at pat@jazzbastard.com or mike@jazzbastard.com. You can drop us a line on Facebook, or if you like, look me up on All About Jazz. The podcast can be downloaded from www.jazzbastard.com, from Stitcher, from Mixcloud, and it can be streamed at All About Jazz. Tune in next time as we talk about four 2019 releases by artists like Jonathan Crompton, Spaza, Curtis Nowosad, and Chase Baird. Till next time, take care.